Sahavīryaṁ karavā vahai tejasvināvadhi tamastu mā vidviṣā vahaihi. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om. Good. Welcome to you all to our first class on Upadesha Sahasri. We expect it to be a smaller class, but I'm glad you've come. Since we're a smaller class, can I request that no one sit in the back row? I can't see you. You're in the dark, and it'd be nice to have everyone sit a little more forward since we're a smaller class. You're okay. Just going forward, if you don't mind just sitting a little bit more towards the front of the hall. Before I introduced the text, some important information to share with you. One is that the text that we'll be using with my translation is available on our website. You can print out a copy. Many students like to take notes. That's not a bad idea. Also, this class is being videoed, so if you miss a class, you can watch the video, and it'll be important to maintain continuity. You can also invite any friends of yours to watch the class. If you have any questions on each class, please send me an email. Those emails will tell me what I need to address in class, so please email me with your questions. And finally, we're still requiring masks. At some point in the hopefully near future, we'll make masks optional, but I've been advised that for the time being, it's probably best that we continue to wear masks. So I know you understand. Okay, anything else? Oh, just before we introduce the particular text, Upadesha Sahasri of Sri Shankaracharya, this is our Vedanta class. So what is Vedanta and how is this different from our Bhagavad Gita class? The Bhagavad Gita class, as I mentioned Saturday, is more spirituality in day-to-day life. It's applied spiritual teachings, whereas this Tuesday evening Vedanta class, which has been on hiatus for 2 years, is just pure focused Vedanta. So it'll be a more deep kind of inquiry. What is Vedanta? Let me just make a personal comment before I get into these details. And that is, one of the reasons I'm so delighted we're restarting this class is it's as good for me as it is for you. We need to be deeply engaged in these teachings for a long period of time for this transformation of our thinking to take place. At some point in the text, we'll have a discussion about Nididhyasana. I don't want to get into that right now. But the importance of regular study cannot be understated. But when I use the word study, it has to be a study in quotation marks, because what Vedanta is not is a subject that you study. Vedanta is not a subject matter that you are intended to study. And many of you have heard my joke before, and that is, if you're coming here to study Vedanta on Tuesday nights, you're wasting your time. Please don't come. Because what we're going to be engaged in is not a scholarly study of this text, but rather Vedanta, as most of you understand very well, is a spiritual tradition that is meant to solve the problem of human suffering. Our goal is not to learn what Shankaracharya taught. Our goal is to gain moksha, liberation, and freedom from suffering in this very lifetime. Turns out these teachings of Vedanta are extraordinarily powerful in leading you to moksha. But let's not mistake the container for the contents. So Upadesha Sahasri is the container. The content is what we're after. And even content is not the right word. Vedanta, properly understood, is a process of self-inquiry guided by these teachings, eventually culminating in the discovery of your true nature and thereby gaining freedom from suffering. The reason it's called Vedanta, if you don't already know this, it's important to know. The Vedas have several parts. The final part of each of the four Vedas is called Upanishads, and it's in those Upanishads that these spiritual teachings are found. Since they are at the anta, or end, of the Veda, therefore it's called Veda Anta, Vedanta. So the spiritual teachings based on the Upanishads, the wisdom of the ancient rishis that's collected at the end of each of the four Vedas. And finally, just to introduce Shankaracharya, the author, it would also be a mistake, just as it would be a mistake to come here to study Vedanta, it would be a mistake to think that Shankaracharya is the founder of the tradition of Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta. Shankara didn't found anything. What he did is he took that wisdom of the ancient rishis and he made it extraordinarily clear. And he did that primarily through writing commentaries, commentaries on the Upanishads, commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, also on the Brahma Sutras. And in addition to all those commentaries, he wrote this wonderful text, among others. So he didn't invent Advaita Vedanta. It was already there. But his clarity is, I would argue, unsurpassed even today. So Shankara lived how many centuries ago? And in all that intervening time, no one has come to teach Vedanta more clearly than Sri Shankaracharya, which is why we study his works today. After all, we think he lived around the 8th century CE, so that's 1,200 years ago. So, and no one has done better in 1,200 years, so that's why we're studying his text. This Upadesha Sahasri, there are many, many independent texts attributed to Sri Shankara. The technical term for these texts is Prakarana Grantha. Grantha simply means book. Prakarana means a method. So books that undertake a certain method of teaching or a certain topic. In fact, Prakarana would better be translated in this context as topic. Of course, in Sahasri means 1,000 Upadesha teachings. So in these 1,000 teachings, we're going to see not one topic, but many topics. By the way, Sahasri, don't think there are exactly 1,000 verses in this text. It is not so. In fact, the text is broken up in two major portions. There, it begins with three chapters of prose, which we're not going to study. And following the three chapters of prose, there are 19 chapters of verses. And it's that metrical portion of the text that we'll be studying. So we'll start with chapter 1 and we'll see how it goes. I think I wrote it down, 675 verses in those 19 chapters. So if we continue, we may not continue with this text, I'm not sure, but if we continue through the end, these classes will continue for quite a while to cover those 19 chapters and 675 verses. There are several commentaries on this text. Generally, we study these texts with Sanskrit commentaries. Anandagiri is famous as the Tikakara, the sub-commentator, who wrote sub-commentaries on all of Shankara's works. His commentary on this text, though, is quite brief. There's a more elaborate commentary by one Ramatirtha. You don't need to remember any of this. Ramatirtha lived, we think, in the 16th century. Anyway, he has a more elaborate commentary on Shankara's text, and I find it very helpful. So, of course, I study these commentaries prior to the class. I won't be teaching the commentaries, but maybe from time to time I may quote from it, but it kind of guides me as I prepare for the classes. Okay, and I think our introduction is complete. And we can begin with the first verse. There we are. So the first verse, there's a convention and a tradition, which I'll describe in just a moment, which is to begin a text with a prayer verse, especially a long text like this should begin with a prayer. Repeat after me, please. Chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam. Chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam. Sarva-bhuta-guha-shayam. Sarva-bhuta-guha-shayam. Yat-sarva-vishayatitam. Yat-sarva-vishayatitam. Tasmai sarva-vide namaha. Tasmai sarva-vide namaha. So the prayer, you can see it in the final line. Tasmai, unto him, namaha, salutations. So unto some particular form of Ishvara, salutations. Now, it's kind of interesting to note that most teachers have an Ishta Devata, a chosen form of God. And many people puzzle over who was Shankaracharya's Ishta Devata, chosen form of God. Bear in mind that we think he's inaugurated many temples in which all various forms of Ishvara are worshipped. Oh, there's one more thing, an introduction I missed. I'll come back to it in a moment. So you might think then, who is Shankaracharya's Ishta Devata? Many people will just jump to the conclusion, Shankara. After all, Shankara is Lord Shiva, his namesake. And in general, Advaita Vedanta has been pigeonholed, if I can use that term, as a Shaiva tradition. Not true. It's true that many Advaitins are Shaivas. It's equally true that most Shaivas are not Advaitins. So don't make these assumptions. That I think it's really a mistake to label Advaita Vedanta as a Shaiva. Shaiva means focused on Lord Shiva. So it's, even though in some, especially in some parts of South India, there's a strong Shaiva connection, but in general, that would be a mistake to make that assumption. And to back that up, it's interesting that in Shankara's, I did some research, in the introductory verse to his famous text, Aparoksha Anubhuti, in the prayer verse, he addresses Hari, Lord Vishnu. Then in Viveka Chudamani, perhaps one of his most well-known texts, he addresses in the prayer verse, Govinda. Now, a little tricky, which Govinda are you talking about? It could certainly be Sri Krishna. It could also be his guru. His guru happened to be named Govinda. But he didn't begin those texts with a prayer to Lord Shiva. And in some texts, he doesn't have a prayer verse at all. In Atma Bodha, he doesn't have a prayer verse. In this text, he begins with this prayer verse, which we'll see in just a moment. And what I missed in my introduction is this. amongst all the texts authored by Shankaracharya, like Aparoksha Anubhuti, Atma Bodha, and Viveka Chudamani, perhaps his best known text, Upadesha Sahasri stands out amongst all of them as being the only text, the only independent text that all scholars unanimously agree were actually authored by Sri Shankaracharya. Many texts are attributed to him even though they're not written by him. How do we know they're not written by him? They contain certain teachings that are contrary to what he taught. Now, I haven't personally done this research, but some scholars have looked into it quite carefully, analyzing the teachings of Viveka Chudamani and finding several passages, not much, several passages that contradict what Shankara has taught elsewhere. So therefore, scholars will conclude that Viveka Chudamani is not authored by Shankara himself. You might say, well, then how is it attributed to Shankara? There's an interesting trick in ancient times. Suppose you wrote a big text on Advaita Vedanta, and a big meaning, Viveka Chudamani, I think, is about 600 verses long. So if you were a teacher in the lineage of Shankaracharya, and you wrote this important text, you would want it to survive. Remember, in those days, the texts were written on palm leaves. And if you wanted a text to survive, students had to be sufficiently motivated to write out their own copies. That's what was done. So your class begins, you get a copy of the text, you write out your own copy. But here's the trick. Students will only make copies of texts they think are really important. It takes a lot of work to write all of that out. And the trick is, if you wrote this big text and you are an unknown teacher of Advaita Vedanta, maybe students won't copy out your text. So if you are a disciple in the lineage of Shankaracharya, and you wrote this big text and you wanted your text to survive, instead of putting your own name on it, what would you do? That's right. You put the name Shankara. Shankaracharya is now, the authorship is attributed to Shankara to ensure the survival of the text. That happened quite a bit. Now the next question becomes, and last question before we return to our text, last question is, how do we know which texts are really written by Shankara and which are not? Well, scholars will just go on arguing about this endlessly. And the fact that they conclude Viveka Chudamani is not authored by Shankara himself doesn't mean that it's a bad text or not worthy of study. It is worthy of study. Absolutely worthy of study. So it has a few little glitches, we'll call them. If your computer has one or two glitches, do you throw it away? So if a text has one or two glitches, you're not necessarily going to throw it away. Anyway, the bottom line here is this Upadesha Sahasri is pretty much the only independent text that all scholars unanimously agree is actually the work of Shankara. So you don't have any doubts at all with regard to this text. And it'll be great for our study as we proceed. So we begin with his prayer verse. And in the prayer verse, he doesn't address Lord Shiva. He doesn't address Lord Hari, Lord Vishnu, as he did in his Aparoksha Anubhuti. He doesn't address his guru, Govinda, as he did in Viveka Chudamani. What form of God does he address? Very revealing, and revealing because there is a trick that's often employed by great authors like Shankara, and that is to make your opening verse do double duty. Double duty means the verse should both be a prayer and simultaneously it should introduce the subject matter. And great scholars can very easily do this, to make a verse do double duty. So he introduces the subject matter of the text in the form of a prayer. And to do so, he addresses not a particular deity, but he addresses, you see, tasmai unto him, namaha, salutations, unto what form of God? Sarvavide. Sarvavit means, the common translation is omniscient, all-knowing. But we need to understand that word properly. What it means is consciousness. What is the first word of the text? Chaitanyam, which is the most common word for consciousness. Consciousness, we can use words like chit and chaitanya. They mean consciousness. Sometimes we use jnanam. Sometimes jnanam means knowledge. Sometimes jnanam means a thought. Sometimes jnanam just means consciousness. A few other words, jnapti, we use, spurti. These are words used perhaps a little less commonly to mean consciousness. And before we begin, please note our definition of consciousness. It's crucial. Consciousness is that by which you know what you're experiencing right now. Right now you're having an experience. Is that experience known to you or unknown to you? Obviously, whatever you're experiencing right now is known to you. It's known to you because of consciousness. We could say, it's a little awkward in English, we could say the knownness of this experience is consciousness. This experience is known because of consciousness, and later in the text we'll see a common metaphor, and that is consciousness illumines the activities of your mind. Right now, this experience is taking place in your mind, right? Your eyes and ears are picking up whatever is happening around you. Your eyes and ears convey all that information to your mind. And in your mind is an image of me. In your mind are words emerging as I speak them. That actually occurs at two levels. Obviously, it occurs in the room. I'm sitting here in a room. The room is filled with the sound of my voice. But all of this is also taking place in the so-called room of your mind. Neuroscience has been studying this very deeply and starting to understand how it is that our sense organs function with the brain to create all of this amazing it's the fact that we experience anything at all is it's a miracle. It is just so incomprehensibly complex what needs to take place for you to see me or hear me. Anyway, the bottom line is whatever you see or hear arises in the room of your mind, so to speak, and you are aware of it, you are conscious of it. And we generally use the words awareness and consciousness as synonyms. We do no difference whatsoever. So we can say you are aware of this experience, you are conscious of this experience. So here, now the question becomes, what is the nature of that consciousness? And that really is the focal point of the teachings of Vedanta and the focal point of this text, Upadesha Sahasri. What is the nature of consciousness? And that is such a fundamental question that is so rarely inquired into, except for circles like ours, where we're deeply engaged in that inquiry. You may know this, but you should know this, that science has endeavored for a long time to understand consciousness, and scientists are deeply divided about the nature of consciousness, and they don't agree on anything. There are many scientists who say consciousness doesn't exist. Huh? Note our definition of consciousness. Consciousness is that because of which you can have an experience. There are plenty of scientists and philosophers who claim, Western philosophers, who claim there is no such thing as consciousness. They ascribe to the modern scientific worldview, which is a materialistic worldview. The world is matter and energy, nothing else. Consciousness is not matter. By the way, please don't think of consciousness as energy. Energy understood in a modern scientific form is the equivalent of mass. Remember Professor Einstein? He used to live down the road here about 20 miles in Princeton. So Professor Einstein showed the equivalence of matter and energy. So if you say consciousness is energy, that's the equivalent to saying consciousness is matter. So anyway, don't. Energy is a word, it's kind of like a new age word. They talk about energy and auras and all of this stuff. We don't talk like that. So we want to be very clear in our understanding. Consciousness is neither matter nor energy. Matter and energy are part of a materialistic worldview. Then we come to most spiritual worldviews. Most. Not this one. Most spiritual worldviews acknowledge the existence of consciousness and material. There is a material world and there is consciousness. Often they'll use the words matter and spirit or matter and consciousness. There are a minority of scientists who are trying to understand what that consciousness is outside of the world of matter. And these scientists and philosophers are so perplexed. One famous philosopher called it the hard problem. The hard problem of consciousness is the term he coined to express something they simply can't understand. And they can't understand because science is a pursuit that's focused outside into the world. Science is an externally focused pursuit. And consciousness is present in your own experience in here. Out there, and we're going to talk about this much more in the coming verses, consciousness cannot be found or studied out there, and that's the problem science is up against. Consciousness can only be understood in terms of your own experience. Right now, whatever you're experiencing is because of consciousness. You are conscious of this experience, aware of this experience. This experience is known to you. You are a conscious being who knows what you're experiencing right now. I'll say that one more time, and then we'll proceed. You are a conscious being, sat and chit, conscious chit, being sat. You are sat chit, a conscious being who knows what is being experienced right now. Okay, we'll come back to this important teaching later. Now, here Shankara addresses not an individual consciousness. He addresses in his prayer Sarvavit, the knower of all. By the way, to translate that as omniscient or all-knowing, as I did, all-knowing is literally correct, but it's not helpful. Instead of saying all-knowing, be better to say the knower of all. And there's a small difference there. All-knowing gives you the idea of someone with a huge mind, a huge brain. But here, knower of all would be a much better translation. Consider this. The knower of what's happening in your mind, the knower of what's happening in my mind, the knower of what's happening in the mind of every sentient being, not only on this planet, but any other place where there are sentient beings, that one and the same consciousness is present in each and every one of these sentient beings. And this is one of the first topics we're going to see, and that is that consciousness, in your own experience, consciousness is private, individual. You feel that you are an individual conscious being. But that conclusion is wrong. It feels like that. But so often, feelings are misleading. You can't trust all these feelings. Feelings come and go. And the example I've given before is when you sleep on your arm and you wake up and your arm doesn't have any sensation in it, your arm is numb, it feels like the arm is not part of you when your arm is completely numb. And the reason I'm giving that example is to show you how feelings are misleading. Don't assume everything you feel is real. What you feel what you feel. Fine. Doesn't make it real. Is the arm part of you or is it not part of you? Well, depends. Most of the time it feels like part of you. Sometimes it feels like it's not part of you. Be forewarned. What you feel is not an accurate guide as to what is real. Feeling does not equal reality. Okay, which means here, is it possible that the consciousness by which my thoughts are known and the consciousness by which your thoughts are known, could it be one and the same consciousness? Just like there's one light that illumines all of us in the room. Actually, there are several lights, I know, but we can think of the light collectively as one collective light in the ceiling coming down, illumining us all. One sun shining outside, illumining everyone. That's a commonly used metaphor in Advaita Vedanta. Just as one sun illumines all on the earth, in the same way, one consciousness reveals what's happening in your mind and reveals what's happening in my mind. Now, the question always comes, what if it's one and the same consciousness, then Swamiji, why don't I know what you're thinking? Is the same consciousness in my mind? Is the same consciousness in your mind? So why don't I know what you're thinking? Tell me, that question occurs in your mind, or is that question asked by consciousness? First of all, consciousness can't ask questions. It doesn't have a mouth. It doesn't have a mind. It's just pure knowing. Pure knowing doesn't ask questions. There's a question in your mind. And the question in your mind is, Swamiji, why don't I know what's happening in your mind? Well, naturally, the question in your mind, your mind is completely separate from my mind. So naturally, your thoughts are part of your private experience. Philosophers like these terms, private experience and public experience. So your thoughts are part of your private experience. My thoughts are part of my private experience. But consciousness is one and the same. And that is the consciousness which Shankara calls Sarvavit, the knower of all. Wherever there is sentiency, it is due to the same consciousness. The consciousness by which you know your thoughts, the consciousness by which I know my thoughts, the consciousness by which Ishvara functions. One and the same consciousness. Called here, Sarvavit, the knower of all. Sarvavide, unto that consciousness, that all-knowing consciousness, namaha. Salutations. Let's finish this verse. So tasmai, salutations unto that consciousness. Go up a verse. Yat, the consciousness which, now go up to the top. Salutations unto that all-knowing one, yat, who is, top line, chaitanyam, consciousness. Now, yes, I think we did it enough. Consciousness, which is sarvagam. There's our key word, all pervasive. That which is gone everywhere, literally, is all pervasive. Consciousness is not stuck inside your head. Consciousness is not stuck inside your body. Now, you notice that you feel what happens to your body, and you don't feel what's beyond your body, but that's not due to the limitation of consciousness. It's due to the limitation of your body. Consciousness is equally present in this arm and equally present in this arm, the arm of the chair. I'll say that again. Consciousness is equally present in my arm and the arm of this chair. What is the difference? My arm is full of nerves. This arm is not. Which is why if I fall asleep on my arm and it's numb, this numb arm kind of feels the same as the arm of the chair, right? So what we're talking about then is not the presence or absence of consciousness. What we're talking about is the presence and absence of sensation. Sensation is confined to your body due to the nature of your nervous system. Oh, I gave this. I like this weird science fiction-y kind of example. Suppose my nerves extended out through my skin, this is creepy, my nerves extended out through my skin and penetrated the arm of this chair. If my nerves penetrated the arm of this chair, then touching the chair would be like touching my body. You get it? So I'm just emphasizing this fact that, as I said before, what you feel doesn't prove anything. The fact that you feel what's happening to your body and you don't feel what's happening to an object, those feelings don't prove anything if they're properly understood. So consciousness is sarvagam, equally present in a sentient being like you and me, equally present in an insentient thing, like this chair, equally present. Not more present, not less present, equally present. Of course, you and I are utterly unlike the chair, because what we hinted at before was the incredible complexity of our minds and brains, which allow this lump of flesh to be a thinking, feeling, sentient being. So, because of the if the chair had a brain and mind as complex as yours, this chair would be saying, "Why are you sitting on me?" How's that? Think about it. If the chair were as intelligent as you, it wouldn't be very happy to have me sitting here. Okay, bad joke. Okay, let's continue here. So that consciousness is sarvagam, all pervasive, and sarvam. It's a simple word with a very profound meaning here. Sarvam means all. Shankara just said that the consciousness which pervades the cosmos, he said, it is sarvam, all. This is why his teachings are called Advaita, non-dual. A few minutes ago, I made a point and I didn't finish it, and that is where science says everything is material, right? This is just three big worldviews. One is a scientific worldview called materialism. Everything is matter and energy. Then we come to most spiritual and religious traditions, which say, well, there is matter and energy, there's also consciousness. Matter and spirit, matter and energy. Dualistic, right? That's dualism. So materialism is one doctrine. Dualism says there is matter, a world of matter and energy, and there is also consciousness that pervades the universe. But Shankara just said that this consciousness is sarvam. All pervasive consciousness is sarvam, all. This is his non-dual teachings. And this is really the culminating teaching of Vedanta, so we can't explain it in great detail here, but let me use some general terms to help you get the big picture. The big picture is this. The consciousness because of which you know what's happening right now is not only all-pervasive, which you've understood from our discussion, but in addition to it being all-pervasive, that consciousness happens to be the underlying reality because of which everything exists. We sometimes use the term fabric of existence, the substratum of the cosmos. So just as a pot exists because of an underlying reality called clay, the universe of matter and energy exists because of which an underlying reality that we usually call Brahman. Here, Shankara calls it Chaitanyam. Brahman, the underlying reality because of which everything exists, and consciousness are not two different realities. This is the big teaching of Vedanta. Tat Tvam Asi is what leads you to recognize the non-difference between your consciousness and the underlying reality called Brahman. They are one and the same. Again, this is the huge vision of Vedanta, and we're only going to give it here in just an outline, a sketch. But some of you know that one of the Mahavakyas is Prajnanam Brahma. Have you heard that? Prajnanam Brahma means Brahman is, prajnanam is another word for consciousness. So, if you feel this isn't perfectly understood right now, that's probably good. Because if you think you understand everything right now, maybe you've got a little problem. So it's okay if this particular point isn't completely understood. Let's call it our destination, the hypothesis we seek to not prove, to discover the truth of this hypothesis. Hold it right now as a hypothesis. And what is that hypothesis? That the consciousness by which you know what's happening right now, that consciousness is not only all-pervasive, but that consciousness is also the underlying reality because of which everything exists. And if that consciousness is the underlying reality, then there is only one reality. It's just as the reality of the pot is nothing but clay, the reality of the universe is nothing but prajnanam brahma. Right? Consciousness. That's non-duality. That's where we come to one. Notice that most religious and spiritual traditions, including the traditions of yoga and Sankhya, and if you know of Vaisheshika and the other Nyayamatas, all of these philosophical systems are dualistic. They hold that there's a world of matter and energy on one hand, and on the other hand, there is consciousness. But Advaita Vedanta rejects that and says there is but one reality, that reality, prajnanam brahma. So here Shankara says that chaitanyam, that consciousness, is not only sarvagam, all-pervasive, but it is also sarvam. It is the underlying reality because of which everything exists. And that consciousness is sarva bhuta guha guha ashayam. A little easier to understand. Ashaya, it has its abode, consciousness has its abode in the guha. Guha you may know as cave, but here it's a metaphor for your heart, and heart is a metaphor for your mind. So guha refers to your mind here. So sarva bhuta guha, existing in the mind of sarva bhuta, every sentient being. The consciousness whose ashaya, whose abode, the consciousness which abides in the mind of every sentient being. As we said before, the consciousness which illumines my thoughts is identical to the consciousness which illumines your thoughts. And one more adjective here in the third line, that consciousness is sarva vishaya atitam. This is bring us back to the problem of science. This consciousness is atita, beyond sarva vishaya, all objects. This consciousness is beyond all objects. This consciousness is not an object that you can know. This is one of the big problems in both science and Vedanta. So here's the problem of science, is science knows about things, stuff. Science uses tools to measure things and stuff. But consciousness, as you understood before, is not a thing. It's not a stuff. How much does consciousness weigh? How tall is consciousness? How wide is it? You get the point. Consciousness is not a material thing. It's not an object that can be known. In That's what the term means here. Sarva Vishaya Atitam, beyond all objects, means it's not a knowable thing. It's not a knowable object. That leads us to one of the central challenges in Vedanta, because you've heard it said many times that you have to gain atmajnanam. You have to gain self-knowledge. And then here I just said, consciousness can't be known. Consciousness can't be known, but you have to gain knowledge of it. What? It sounds like a contradiction. It's not, of course. But here's the point. Consciousness is not knowable. Consciousness is the nature of the knower. This will challenge you if you haven't heard this before. Hear that again. Consciousness is not a knowable. The world is knowable. Consciousness is the knower. And the knower can never be known. Objects can be known. The knower can't. For the knower to know itself is meaningless, because a knower has a relationship with a known. There's a relationship between knower and known. If there's no known, if there's only a knower, how can the knower know itself? The knower is consciousness. Consciousness that just shines. That's a little abstract. A common metaphor that's often used is this. Does the sun need to illumine itself to shine? Hear that again. Does the sun need to illumine itself in order to shine, in order to be seen? You get the point. The sun just shines. It doesn't shine on itself. It just shines. Consciousness just shines, metaphorically. The sun doesn't shine on itself. Consciousness doesn't reveal itself. Now, you've no doubt you've read books or you've heard different things said about someone discovering the true self, consciousness, in deep meditation. Somebody will say that in deep meditation, the true self arose like a blinding light, shining like a thousand suns. You've heard expressions like this. Here's the problem with that. If in meditation you have this amazing experience, you can have it. It's not that difficult to have these experiences. Suppose in meditation you experience a bright light shining like a thousand suns. That's your experience in meditation. Tell me, is that experience known to you or unknown to you? Known to you. How is it known to you? You get it? You are the consciousness by which that thousand sun light in your mind is known. That experience of a thousand suns, that brightness, is an experience arising in your mind, and it is known to you, the conscious observer. We use the word sakshi, awareful witness, to describe that conscious observer, awareful witness. So, you are that conscious being, sakshi, the awareful witness of whatever arises in your mind. All the objects of your experience that arise in your mind, all objects are known to you because you are the sakshi, the awareful observer. You are the conscious witness of all of that. Consciousness itself cannot be observed. Let's be very clear about it. Right now, you see me as a you think you are watching a conscious being. My question is, do you experience consciousness? You see my body. Do you somehow sense my consciousness? Now, you hear, hopefully, intelligent words coming out of my mouth, meaningful words, but you're experiencing the vision, the sight of my body. You're experiencing my words. You don't experience or sense or observe my consciousness. Consciousness is not an observable. Consciousness is not a knowable. Consciousness is the knower. And here's the big difference between science and Vedanta. Science is concerned with knowing the world. Vedanta is concerned not with the known, but with the knower. And the metaphor, some of you have heard me use this before. To me, the scientist is metaphorically looking through a microscope, looking through the microscope at whatever is on the slide underneath the microscope. What Vedanta does, it turns the whole thing around. So instead of paying attention to what's on that side of the microscope lens, Vedanta turns your attention to what's on this side of the microscope lens. It's completely opposite in its orientation. And that's what this expression means. Sarva Vishaya Atita, beyond all objects. Vedanta is not an inquiry into a thing called consciousness. Vedanta is an inquiry into your own experience. Now, one last thing to share with you tonight, and that is, if consciousness cannot be known as an object, then how do you gain self-knowledge? Do you see the issue here? Consciousness is not knowable. It's the known. But then how do we use terms like Atma Buddha, self-knowledge, Atma Jnana, self-knowledge, self-realization? You've heard me say discovery of your true nature. We use this language all the time, but understand it properly. Knowledge here means, and we'll make this clear. This will be the last thing for tonight. Tell me, this is a trick question. Is your consciousness known to you or unknown to you? If I ask you, are you conscious? You have to say, wait a minute, I have to think about that. Well, the fact that you're thinking suggests that you're conscious. You already know you are a conscious being. Consciousness is already present in your ordinary experience right now. Correct? Consciousness is already present. It's not totally unknown, but you don't understand the nature of that consciousness. In fact, you've got plenty of wrong conclusions about that consciousness. What Vedanta does, and I'm going to be very careful in my language here, Vedanta does not reveal consciousness. Consciousness is already revealed, self-revealing, already fully and completely present right now in this ordinary experience. What Vedanta does is remove all your wrong conclusions about consciousness. Like consciousness is stuck inside your body. Consciousness is stuck inside your head. Your consciousness is subject to sadness and pain. That's a pretty common conclusion. Consciousness is subject to sadness and physical pain. Suppose you could discover that consciousness, your consciousness, is not subject to pain and sadness. To discover that your consciousness is not subject to pain and sadness means you, in your true nature, are not subject to pain and sadness. You are free from suffering. This is how Vedanta works. We're going to see, actually, in the next class, I think we'll get there, the famous Vedantic dictum, neti, neti, not this, not this. Vedanta doesn't reveal consciousness. It's already revealed, doesn't need to be revealed. What these teachings do are to remove all your wrong conclusions about consciousness. You know the rope snake story? Interesting. The rope is already present, but you see it as a snake. You've made a mistake. So the solution, if you see the rope snake in the dark alley, the solution is not to reveal the rope. The rope is already there. The solution is to remove your wrong conclusion that it's a snake. So it's all negation. Neti, neti, not this, not this. And through this process of negation, the very skillful process of negation we find in these scriptures, all of your wrong conclusions about who you are, your wrong conclusions are removed. Turns out, all suffering is due to wrong conclusions you've made about yourself. When you remove all those wrong conclusions, you will find that suffering truly comes to an end. Not metaphorically. Suffering really and truly comes to an end through this process of negation. So we need, and we'll see this in several more verses, the problem is ignorance. The solution, just as you're ignorant of the rope, here you're ignorant of your true nature. You're ignorant of the nature of consciousness. And by removing that ignorance, neti, neti, by removing the ignorance, the problem of suffering is solved. That actually comes in verse 5, so I'm getting ahead of myself. But we will pick up the thread next week, continuing with verse 2. Any other announcements I'm supposed to make? I think that's good. So it's wonderful to have resumed this class, and I look forward to this is going to be a wonderful study of this text, and I'm looking forward to the future classes. We'll just conclude with our simple prayers to conclude our program today. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Hamritangamaya Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Tat Sat. Very nice.